Welcome to International Tax Bites, a series of conversations around issues and concepts in international taxation. I'm Graham Jackson, and I'm a Gibraltar and English solicitor with Hassan's International Law Firm in Gibraltar. Today, I will be speaking to my podcast partner, Harriet Brown, who is a Jersey advocate and English barrister with Old Square Tax Chambers in London.
Harriet, here we are.
Here we are again.
With
some exciting news.
The Chancellor has gone mad and devastated 200 years of historic systems with his announcement in the budget. Where are we? Yesterday. So today is the 7th of March. So it was on the 6th of March, 2024. The Chancellor sounded the death knell for the remittance basis of taxation, which was introduced in...
A long time ago, in the
almost 200 years ago.
That's what we thought. Yes, we have no exact information because this all just happened. So, you know, we haven't done that much research.
No, but we have read the technical note.
We have read the technical note, which is all we've got at the moment because we don't.
Because he rushed it through to announce it to knacker the Labour Party.
Look, I don't know about politics. I can't comment on that.
So that's where I'm betting. That maybe we don't have any legislation because there hasn't been time since he decided to do it to do the legislation.
What the technical note says about that is further updates and draft legislation will be published later in the year for technical comments. Some points of detail concerning IHT will be settled after consultation with representative bodies and other interested parties.
So the Chartered Institute of Tax would be there?
I think so.
Would be a representative body, you would expect. The technical committees of the Chartered Institute of Tax, of which we are both fellows, are beavering away even as we speak.
I have no doubt that they are.
Yeah. I'm on one.
I know you are.
Yeah.
Not they didn't want me. Never mind.
You should be on the international taxes one.
I think they've got Emma, so they really don't need me.
Right, okay. Right, that was a barristry thing. Sorry to anybody who didn't understand what that was about. Right, so, okay. So what's he, I mean, the headline is he's abolished non-dom. First of all, let's just describe what non-dom go on.
So non-dom is a shortened form of saying non-UK domiciled, which means not domiciled in any part of the United Kingdom.
Because that's very important because you're domiciled in England, Wales or Scotland or Northern Ireland.
Or Northern Ireland, yeah.
Not UK.
Not the UK, yes. I think that is a hangover because domicile as a concept, I think, came from ecclesiastical law way back in the day.
No idea.
Probably not relevant.
It might be relevant to applicable law, right? So Scotland and Northern Ireland would be important distinctions to make there.
Yeah, and I think that's the context. I think that's the context in which it arose. But anyway, and so essentially, it was a common law, or it is, because we've got all the existing position will continue until the 6th of April 2025. So you have just over a year to plan or to help your clients plan. But domicile is a common law concept, which is basically about where you belong. So it's sort of. It had a number of limbs. It's things like you had domicile of origin, which is the origin of your father when you were born, unless your parents were not married, then it's the domicile of your mother when you were born. You have a domicile of choice, which is when you effectively you go somewhere and you intend to remain there permanently or indefinitely, and that will cancel out your domicile of origin. There's a domicile of dependence, which is mostly irrelevant nowadays anyway. And then, of course, you can lose your domicile of choice. If you lose your domicile of choice without gaining another one, you will revert to your domicile of origin. So you always have only one domicile, and you always have to have a domicile. So yeah. It's sort of the best way that I can describe it is it's where you belong.
Yeah. So let's give an example, right, okay, of the difference between residence and domicile. So let's imagine that I am a salesman who lives in England with my wife and three children, but my job is traveling around France selling things. right? Okay. So I go for 200 days a year to France, and I stay in hotels all over France, right? And I sell my, I have my little briefcase widgets. Full of samples. Yeah, of widgets. And I sell them to the widget buyers of France. So I'd be over 183 days in France, right? So I'd be resident in France. But I belong in England, right? So my domicile would remain English. I mean, yes. we could argue about the statutory residence test and which how many sufficient ties I've got and all those, blah, blah, blah. But let's ignore that.
That affects domicile anyway.
Yeah, but I would be resident in France, but domiciled in England because my real home is England, even though I stay in France.
And so you can have a sort of a bizarre situation where somebody remains in one country for an extremely long time, but remains domiciled somewhere else. And I think the standard example that's always given is the case of Bullock, where a Canadian airman married somebody from the UK, and he always intended to return to Canada if his wife predeceased him or he could persuade her to move. He predeceased her, but he'd never gained a domicile of choice in the UK because he did not intend to remain here permanently or indefinitely.
Right.
So that's, decade, I think, wasn't
that's
he?
Frankly a ridiculous position from a tax perspective because domicile affects lots of taxes. So they introduced deemed domicile, which at today's date, this has changed, but at today's date, if you are present in the, if you're resident in the UK for 15 of the last 20 years, then you will be deemed to be domicile, even if you are not domiciled.
Actually domiciled.
In England.
Yeah.
Or the UK.
And being domiciled gives you access to all sorts of fantastic things like the remittance basis.
Or being non-domiciled.
Sorry, yes. Being non-domiciled. The concept of domicile is used as a gateway for the remittance basis. So if you are resident in the UK but not domiciled in the UK, there's a regime that has got increasingly complex over time, but essentially what it means is if you have income or gains outside the UK, unless you remit them to the UK, you don't pay tax on them in the UK.
So foreign income, it's essentially a foreign income exclusion rule.
It is, with some complications, but that's going. So if you're
That's the old scheme, and that's or the old rule, and that's now going to be abolished from
6th of April 2025. That's
6th of April 2025. So you've got 1 year
and some days,
and 29 or 30 days, depending on how many days there are in March, which I can never remember. Okay, so anyway, just over a year, non-dom will be finally finished. Now, there's been some pressure, hasn't there, on this status because of politics and The Guardian
and Rishi Sunak's wife,
you know, the domination of foreign money in central London, property market going crazy. It has had an impact.
I think it has. Some may say that it's a positive impact because even if you have non-UK domiciliaries who are living here and not paying tax on their foreign income and gains, they've been paying tax on their UK income and gains, and they've been paying tax on their remittances, one assumes.
Yeah. So I think the thing is, like all things in life, everything's a bit good and everything's a bit rubbish. Yeah. It's mixed. It's a mixed outcome. Depending on your perspective, it's either been great for the London property market or it's been terrible for the London property market. If you work for a company which is owned by a non-dom that he's established in the UK,
it's been good.
It's brilliant. And they do that, you know. And just so for the listeners, it's not like non-doms just sit in their 18th century house that they've bought on a square somewhere counting piles of money. They do set up businesses and they do operate. So it's just not true to say they don't contribute anything to the economy. They do, but they don't contribute tax on the same level that a person who was born and always lived here, domiciled here, would do. So that change, that difference has now been changed. So what's he going to do? What's he going to replace it with, Harriet?
So this is being replaced with what is called a foreign income and gains regime, or FIG regime.
Oh, what a terrible acronym.
Oh, I like it. So, and what this means in essence is if you qualify for the FIG regime, you won't pay tax on foreign income and gains that arise in the first 4 tax years after you become a UK tax resident. And so it's better because in those first 4 years, you can bring those funds to the UK free from charge. So in that 4 year period, it's quite a good change because you don't have to pay income or gains. Sorry, you don't have to pay tax on income and gains, even if you remit them effectively. However, it's much less generous in terms of the timescale over which it applies.
Right. So that's well, it's in line with New Zealand's transitional residence rule, isn't it? Is that what it's called?
It's a bit like the Italian scheme as well, I'm told, but I
Except
don't
it
know.
doesn't cost you 250,000 euros a year to.
Not evidently yet, no.
Yeah.
In addition, you don't pay tax on non-resident trust distributions either. And you're in the same position as current non-UK domiciliaries in that you will pay tax on UK source income and gains.
Okay.
So if you are not yet in the UK and you want to come here for a medium sort of amount of time, 4 years, it's probably quite good. You'd be in a better position. The people for whom it represents a less good situation include those who are already tax resident here. And so, for those who are already tax resident here, if you have been here for more than 4 years, you will just go on to the arising basis. There will be some transitional provisions, which we'll come on to in a minute. If you've been here for less than 4 years, by the 6th of April 2025, then you can use the remainder of that 4 year period. You get the FIG regime for that remainder of that 4 year period, but you don't get like a new start. You don't get a new 4 year period from the 6th of April 2025. So it's less good if you've been here a long time. Say you've been here 10 years and you're thinking, well, I've got another 5 years before I'm deemed domicile, for example. You're going to
You're
go on to the,
knackered.
yeah, you're going to go on to, no. You're going to go onto the arising basis on the 6th of April 2025, and you need to think about planning now.
Okay. So, assuming that these people are mobile, yeah, there are several other schemes around the world, aren't there? This is not the only foreign income exclusion.
No, and I think people are going to want to think carefully about what they hope to achieve.
I mean, Italy's got one, Spain's got Beckham rule, Switzerland's famously got one, Gibraltar's got Cat 2, Jersey's got, has Jersey got a formal scheme, or is it a derivative of the actual base taxation system?
So yes, they do have a scheme, but it's more focused on who can buy property, but that feeds into the income tax that you pay. So,
Right. Okay. Yeah. But there are lots of different, other, basically what we're trying to say is like the old Radio Times advert, other foreign income exclusion rules are available.
they are, yes. And I think a lot of people are going to be thinking about where they want to be.
Yeah, I think it will impact on the atmosphere in central London. I think it definitely will.
Okay.
It's got to have an impact because some people will leave.
Yeah, of course. Yeah, I think it's undoubtedly some people will leave. Conversely, it may mean that some people come because you're going to get that 4 years where you can, move your foreign income and gains with impunity in and out of the UK. And
Yeah.
if you've got a short-term purpose, say, I don't know, you want to put a child through sixth form or something like that, it works
Yeah.
quite well, or a short-term business purpose,
University.
University, it's not all bad. It's not all
No.
bad at all. There are opportunities as well as reverse of opportunities. What's the opposite of an opportunity?
Challenges.
Challenges, that's it. Yes, you see. I
See,
so rarely face them that I don't even know what they're called.
this is why I'm here. Keep us grounded. Yeah. Okay, so a lot of these people, and this is what it's quite a few people are going to be thinking about this, because this is He didn't just abolish it, did he? He changed some other things around the outside that was seems very aggressive. So there's a thing called a protected trust under non-dom, isn't there?
So, yes, protected trusts came in a few years back as when they tightened the non-dom period, increased the fee and made some other changes as sort of a sweetener on that. And effectively, a protected trust meant that if you had a trust that was settled by a non-UK domiciled individual, it essentially had trust protection from a variety of capital gains tax and income tax anti-avoidance rules inter alia. And there were some tricky bits around that. So, for example, you couldn't add any value after you became domiciled. And we saw quite a few trusts where errors were made and things had to be unwound. So it's a complicated regime. And from that perspective, getting rid of it is probably a good thing because it was very complex. But it was also very beneficial, particularly for those who might be coming towards the end of their non-UK domicile period.
Yeah, but he's not just, let's just be sure, he's not just said, you can't do that anymore. He's unpicked the treatment for the pre-existing ones as well, right? So if you had a protected trust last week, it was already in place. Come 6th of April 2025, its protection will disappear.
So yeah, what the technical note says is the protection from tax on income and gains arising within settled or interested trust structures will no longer be available for non-domiciled and deemed domiciled individuals who do not qualify for the new four-year FIG regime. FIG arising in the trust, whenever that trust was established, and that's the important bit, from 6th of April 2025 will be taxed on the settlor on the same basis as UK domiciled settlors at present, unless the settlor is eligible for the new four-year FIG regime. So say you settled a trust in 2020 when you were non-UK domiciled, you've had 10 years, so you don't qualify for the new regime, your settlor interested trust will become non-protected, and things like Section 624 of ETOIA and Section 86...
Always a favourite.
Well, it is. And Section 86 of TCGA will apply to you. So you will be taxed on the income of the trust as if it were your income. And that is a pretty punitive change.
Yeah.
In my view.
I just think it's unnecessary. I just don't think... Unless he's gone for revenue raising, he's done it for revenue raising reasons. It seems like the British state has said, we will treat this like this, even if you cease to be domiciled. And then it's gone back on its word.
I mean, a little bit. So in addition, on the trust protection, they say beneficiaries and settlors who are within the four-year FIG regime will also be able to receive benefits from 6th of April 2025, free from any UK tax charge, whether or not the benefits are received in the UK. However, such benefits are not matched to trust income and gains and will be subject to a modified onward gift rule. So again, there's a sweetener, which the protected trust regime was to begin with.
Yeah, but it's not a sweetener for the guy.
No, it isn't. But, you know, I mean, are we looking to attract a different sort of person? I don't know. The politics of it are largely irrelevant at this stage.
So I'm going to come out and say it, right? It feels like an injustice. I know it's odd to talk about non-doms and that, you know, that I'm sure the more campaigny type listeners that we have would say, well, they're very rich and whatever, right?
Being rich doesn't mean it's okay to be unfair.
No, if the state has made a statement, this is how it is, and this is, it's protected, and this is the treatment, to then go back on it.
I think the answer to that would be, well, yes, but you've got a year to sort yourself out, and we can change the way we do things by legislation, and that's what legislation has always been for. This isn't really retrospective in a way that, say, the ECHR is remotely interested in. So what?
No, I'm making a moral statement, and I know you don't like those. I'm making a moral statement.
Must we?
So, that's my little bit over. So there is a type of trust that is permitted, though, for a year, isn't there? You can still settle the old-fashioned...
You can still do trusts. They're not permitted. They're just probably not that
useful. Okay, so there's still a a tax treatment which is available for 1 year. Is it the excluded property trust? You can still do those for a year, and they will retain their status after abolition.
We're talking about something slightly different here. We're talking about inheritance tax now, aren't we?
Ah, yes. Sorry.
So, if we can just finish on the income tax and CGT. So your protected trusts are not going to be protected from the 6th of April 2025. There is something called that they're calling the TRF, the Temporary Repatriation Facility. This is a new 12% rate of tax for remittances of FIG made in 2025/26 and 26/27, where the FIG arose to the individual personally in a year when the individual was taxed on the remittance basis and the individual is UK resident in the relevant tax year. So you get 12% rate in the first two tax years of the new regime if you, as an individual, had income arise to you. And I'm just double checking because I think this is the one that is just income. No, it's income and gains. Sorry, it is gains as well. If you were taxed on the remittance basis and you're resident in the relevant tax year, so you get a very reduced rate of tax where you remit in those 2 years. And they've said they're also going to relax the mixed fund rules to make it easier for individuals to take advantage of the TRF. So that's nice, because I don't think most of us have ever understood the mixed funds rules in any meaningful way anyway.
No, they're very weird.
And then from 27/28, remittances of pre-6th of April 2025 foreign income and gains are going to be taxed at the normal rate. So if you want to bring them in, you probably need to do it in the next 2 years. That doesn't apply to trusts, though, because we were talking about trusts. What else have I got to say? Business investment relief will apply to pre-6th of April 2025 foreign income or gains. And so really, if you have a trust, a protected trust now, that is the first thing that I think you want to be looking at.
So the only situation in which you can have a protected trust, if I'm correct, is that you are no longer a non-dom. It only becomes protected, does it not, after you become deemed domicile?
It does, yes. Well, that's when you need it, yes.
Yeah. So, well, it doesn't have any protection before you cease to be non-dom, because you are non-dom.
Yes, precisely.
Yeah. So by definition, it can't be protected. That doesn't matter. It doesn't matter, right? But it's the people it's going to impact are the ones that are...
Yes. Yeah.
No longer non-dom. So if you were non-dom 20 years ago and you've got this old trust structure sitting in a TCSP somewhere like Guernsey, Jersey, Cayman, Grenada, wherever, Gibraltar. Yeah. Doesn't matter where, Liechtenstein. Yeah. Then it's time to go back and revisit that.
It is, yes. Yeah, absolutely. There is going to be capital gains tax rebasing.
That's always a laugh.
Yeah, we all love a good old capital gains tax rebase, don't we? But again, that's only, I think, looking at it, going to apply to individuals. And it is to the very random date of 5th of April 2019.
Oh.
So, I don't really understand why they've picked that date. Perhaps they'll explain it later on.
5 years ago.
Yeah, I don't know. I can't say. So this sort of abolition of the concept of domicile is going to impact inheritance tax as well, which is when we come onto your excluded property.
Yeah.
So IHT is a domicile-based system, and it is in a lot of places. So what you pay IHT on is largely determined on where you belong, in inverted commas. The UK is going to move that onto a residence-based system. There is going to be a consultation on this. And again, this is going to start from the 6th of April 2025, which doesn't actually give them that long to consult.
Because they're not going to listen anyway. They're just going to do it. I'm sorry. I don't have much faith in consultations.
Look, I think there is certainly evidence to justify that approach, Graham, and I'm not going to prove today.
I mean, just the premise of a consultation is ridiculous. I'm going to consult on this, right? It's stupid. That's my comment. Yeah. Oh, well, I'm going to ignore that one.
I think some people maybe do give constructive comments, though. It's just a thought.
Never give them constructive comments. It encourages them. And so, I wasn't saying that the non-dom reform was stupid. I was saying that that would be a response to some of the consultations that I've seen.
Well, yes, entirely possible. So let's look at what that's going to do, or what the technical note says that's going to do in an IHT context. So new trusts and additions to existing trusts made by a non-UK domiciled settlor on or after 6th April 2025 will be subject to new residence-based rules. So I think what I read that as potentially saying is that you are still possibly going to be able to settle something akin to an excluded property trust, but you're going to have a much shorter time frame in which to do it, is what I'm guessing.
I thought there's quite a lot of promise tucked away in the to be sorted out later.
Potentially, yes.
But the big stick was introduced up front.
Yeah. Yeah,
does that make sense, right?
Yes, I completely agree with you.
Yeah. Anyway.
So shall we start very quickly and just look briefly at what they're proposing for property owned outright?
Go on.
So at the moment, we have a situs domicile-based system. Very similar position. It's 15 out of the last 20 tax years, you become deemed UK domiciled. And you remain deemed domiciled until your fourth year of non-UK residence. What that's going to change to, I'm not sure they really say in any detail. Here we go. What they say is that the new rules are going to involve charging IHT on worldwide assets owned outright when a person has been resident in the UK for 10 years, the residence criteria, with a provision to keep a person in scope for 10 years after leaving the UK, the tail provision. The design of the system, including consideration of further criteria such as other connecting factors, will be subject to consultation. UK situs assets will remain in charge on the same basis as at present, regardless of residence. So this is, I think, a much less extreme position than the income tax one, because we're losing 5 years because it was 15 out of 20 years and now it's 10 years, but we've got a much longer tail. We had a 4-year tail. Now we've got a 10-year tail in which you remain in scope after you leave the UK, in effect. So I think this is a slightly more moderate change in any event.
Right. Okay.
So, and indeed the residence criteria might be easier to apply. So it may be a simplification, though. I'm sure we will find a way to make it more complicated, because we always do.
I'm sure we will.
So trusts, which I think is the more interesting one. What they say they are envisaging, and that is, it says envisaged, but that's a quote, is that the new rules for chargeability of assets comprised in a settlement will depend on whether a settlor meets the residence criteria or is within the tail provision at the time the assets are settled, and or when charges such as 10-year anniversary charges or exit charges arise. And that's really interesting.
Okay.
Because at the moment, when you settle property into a trust when you're non-UK domiciled, it doesn't matter where you're domiciled at the time that the charge arises.
Right.
So that's sort of fixed, subject to all the mess around Barclays Wealth and Section 81 and 81A and all that jazz. So subject to that, what they're saying here seems to be, we are going to look at where you are when you settled the trust, but we are also going to look at where you are when the charge arises. And that's and doesn't seem to be decided whether that's going to be a joint criteria. So it has to be that and that, or it's going to be one or the other. So that is potentially a more significant change, which is interesting, always interesting. they go on to say, again, that they're consulting treatment of non-UK assets that are settled by a non-UK domiciled settlor and become comprised in a settlement prior to 6th of April 2025 will not change. For these settled assets, provided the asset in the settlement continues to meet the legislative requirements to be excluded property under current legislation and subject to any future anti-avoidance provisions, there will be no IHT charges. And the interaction between the gift with reservation provisions and excluded property trust rules also remain, meaning excluded property will not be brought into charge on the settlor's death, even if the settlor retains a benefit in the trust assets. So, hold on.
That sentence you just read out. So it will not be brought into charge on the settlor's death, even if the settlor retains a benefit in the trust assets. That means while the settlor's alive, right? It's not after he's... that he retains benefit.
As far as I'm aware, we're still not required to get out our Ouija boards to administer the inheritance.
It's just slightly oddly written, and it struck me.
Look, why wouldn't it be oddly written?
Yeah, because it was done in about 15 minutes.
Oh, I think maybe slightly longer than that. Come on.
Yeah. Jeremy sent a post-it note round saying, get rid of non-dom, do something. And this is...
Very cynical, Graham. It reflects poorly on you, your cynicism.
No, look, I'll be honest about this. I think he may have decided to do it close to the wire, but I bet there's been discussion papers about this for 30 years.
Absolutely, there has been. There's no doubt about that. This has been something that's come up, I think, in multiple budgets for decades. So, you know, well, Nigel, what's his nut, wanted to get rid of it, didn't he?
Lawson.
Possibly.
Well, he's the only Nigel that I know that's been a chancellor. Nigel Lawson, yeah. Lawson's boom.
Yeah, he wanted to get rid of it, so, you know.
Nigella's dad.
Yeah, Nigella's dad.
Yeah. Yes. I think he's the first chancellor that I really, really remember. I remember Jim Callaghan, Prime Minister, but I don't really remember any other chancellors. Anyway.
You remember Jim Callaghan?
Yeah. I remember the Winter of Discontent.
Oh, yes, of course you do. You're old. I often forget that.
That's nice. Anyway, so that's not non-dom, even though that's the big news in the tax circles, is not the only thing. You're going to talk to me about TOA as well, Transfer of Assets Abroad.
I am going to talk to you about Transfer of Assets Abroad because this was a sneaky one that was slipped in. Wasn't announced formally, but of course they can't announce everything. But we've got a policy paper in all of the documents that come with the budget. And this is about changes to anti-avoidance legislation, transfer of asset abroad provisions. Now, those of you immersed in the UK international tax sort of scene, if I can put it that way, will be aware of the transfer of assets abroad provisions. And you may
All our listeners will be aware. We've done an episode, haven't we?
Yeah, they might not have listened to it, though. I don't remember that being as being at our scintillating best, Graham. There was quite a lot of legislation-based chat.
But you love that.
Yes, but I'm also aware that I'm in a minority of people who love legislation-based chat.
Series 5, Episode 2, if anybody wants to go back.
Thanks, Graham. So, there was a case called Fisher, and Fisher went on for absolutely ages. I was in it in the first tier tribunal, and I was also involved in doing written submissions in it for the CJU. It then continued on into the distance without me, but I mean, literally, this was one of the first things that I ever did. So it took forever to get to the Supreme Court, which it did last year.
How long have you been qualified?
It was 15 years on the 4th of February.
Oh, isn't that nice?
That's in the UK. That's in England and Wales. In Jersey, it's a couple of years longer.
Maybe so I'm old again, is that?
Old and underqualified, I think, Graham.
I'm qualified in two jurisdictions as well. Shut up. Right. Anyway, move on.
Graham is much more qualified than me, I should add, because he is also an addit, and I'm definitely not an addit. But anyway.
And I'm senior to you as a fellow either by about a month.
I'm sorry.
Right.
Yes. So we've had an ego battle that I've comprehensively lost as per. And yes, so Fisher looked at the application of the Transfer of Assets Abroad Code. And ultimately, one of the things that the Supreme Court said was, they said, look, if you are a participator or a person in it, or a person who would be a participator in a non-UK company if it were a UK company, you're not the person making the transfer. You're not the transferor.
Right. And let's just be for the people who a participator. It's a shareholder.
It's a shareholder.
Interpreted broadly.
It's a shareholder in a close company, interpreted broadly.
And a close company is?
Oh, I can't remember.
Less than seven?
No, it's not seven. But anyway, it's a company that's close.
With a limited number of shareholders.
Exactly. And the determining these things is much more complicated than you'd think, because you have to take into account connected people and all the rest of it. But
yeah.
In Fisher, there were, I think, four shareholders. There were four shareholders. And so it was definitely close.
Five or fewer is a close company.
There you go. You see, so there were four of them, I think. And the company made a transfer. And the question arose, were they the transferors, and were they chargeable under these provisions? And ultimately, the Supreme Court said, no, if you are a transferor, the company is a transferor, not the participators of the company.
Refused to pierce the corporate veil.
Something like that, yes. And so the taxpayer won. The taxpayer won in the Supreme
Court. Hurrah.
Hurrah, hurrah. And less than 12 months later, the government is legislating so that that decision of the Supreme Court is effectively reversed by legislation. What they say is the measure introduces a provision that deems individuals who are participators in a close company or a non-resident company that would be close if it, that were UK resident, as transferors to address situations where transfers are made by such companies. This charge will ensure that a transfer made via a company in which the individual is an owner or has a financial interest will be considered a relevant transfer by that individual for the purposes of the TOAA legislation.
So let's just look, there is both justice and injustice in that. Right?
As always.
Because if you are a 2% shareholder in a company with four shareholders, and that company decides to do something that amounts to a transfer for the purposes of TOA, it would seem wrong, because you have no control and you have no influence over what's happened, right? But if you had a smart tax lawyer that took advantage of the fact that it was not a transfer by you, then you could avoid tax. So personally, I hope the legislation takes into account or allows a get out for people who have no ability to influence, I think. I think that would be nice.
The first thing it says is that the measures will not impact transactions where there is no tax avoidance purpose, or where the transactions are generally commercial transactions. So it's not going to override the motive defence.
Right.
Starters. The detailed proposal tells us that they're going to add new sections 720A and 727A to the Income Tax Act 2007. And I love this, because this is a tar in a tar. This is a targeted anti-avoidance rule in something which is already a targeted anti-avoidance rule, it says.
Good God, is there no end to the madness?
Section 720A will apply for the purpose of preventing the avoidance of a liability tax where an asset has been transferred to a person abroad. It will apply to a transfer made by a closely held company such that it will be treated as being made by an individual with a qualifying interest where the individual will have the power to enjoy the income arising abroad. So I think your point, Graham, is there going to be a get out for people who genuinely can't influence it, possibly in the definition of what constitutes a qualifying interest? I don't know. We'll have to see.
So it'd be something like portfolio investments don't count or something like that.
Well, yeah. And then the section 727A allegedly has the same purpose and works in the same way, but it's for individuals who have received a capital sum as the result of the relevant transactions. And that's going to be settlors or transferors who've received a capital sum.
Okay. All right.
That's it, really.
That's it. Right.
Nothing. No work. Nothing for us to do. It's all been tidied up. And people shouldn't worry. No, people shouldn't worry, but there's lots to do. And if you or your clients are going to be impacted by these measures, it's a good idea to start thinking about your options now, even before we've got the legislation, in all honesty.
Hey, yours. pay us to advise. No, obviously, many, many, many highly qualified advisors are out there, especially CTAs and specialist tax barristers and accountants. Yeah, you've got to mention the CTAs. When the head of the Bar Council comes on the podcast, like the president of the CIOT did, then we'll mention the Bar Council.
That's fair.
I don't see why not. We're a global leader, listened to in 126 different countries. Anyway, so, of course, first of all, there's no legislation for us to advise on yet on any of this, so it can't qualify as advice. But just to be sure, this is not advice, does not qualify advice, and is no substitute for competent advice in all the relevant jurisdictions. It's just a conversation between two people talking about tax. Thank you very much for listening. And this will come out in the middle of the mini-series, but it's not part of the mini-series. There's two more episodes to go on that, and we look forward to finishing it off. Thank you very much for listening.
Thank you.